all snapping had been coming from. They tried to make us tell them about the weapons and ammunition stores they said we had and make us confess that we had killed the soldiers, and we knew nothing of any of it. They also wanted the names and addresses of our accomplices. At each wall, the picture was the same. Three men in military uniform beating on civilians. Questions and answers can be heard on all sides, interspersed with shouts of pain as negative answers are followed by the thuds and thuds of blows. So you're an independent, are you? Just wait. We'll have you sing in a minute. So you think you've been brought here by a mistake, do you? Who else is with you? Take this chicken down to the basement. You didn't fire, that's good. Name then those who did. Give us the addresses. Oh, you've lost your papers, have you? Louder, I didn't hear that. Allende was a pederast. Repeat that. They made them say all kinds of ugly names about the great Dr. Allende, who'd helped soldier, worker, all the people alike. If you weren't in the army, where did you learn to shoot? Who trained you? And these people knew nothing of shooting. They were announcers in the radio station. They put one of those under interrogation in front of the lift. That is the elevator. They press the button and the lift doors slide apart. They put his hands in and press the button again. The doors come together on his fingers. The victim groans with horrible pain. There's worse coming to you in the basement. Where are you keeping your weapons? Just listen to that. Everybody is independent now. Then who took part in the marches? Let me handle him. He's from MIPU. That is the Unity Popular Action Movement. From the trouser pockets of a young man in a blue jacket, they pull out an armband of thick fabric with the two letters UP, Unidad Popular, on it. Come on, eat it. Oh, you don't like it? Without salt? I see. You'll have to eat it as it is, otherwise we'll make you eat your own shit, son of a bitch. This is followed by a peal of laughter. Take this frightened tadpole to the basement. He has fainted. The youth with the armband in his mouth is writhing in pain. He's ready to throw up. Put it back into your stinking goddamn mouth. You have to swallow a lot, you dirty dog. All around are bleeding heads with disheveled hair. Get up! Get up! Somebody grabs me by the collar of my jacket, stands me up and points me to a vacant space by the wall next to the elevator. A violent blow sends me flying forward. I trip up against some steps which I hadn't even noticed before. Put your hands up and place them on the wall. Keep your legs apart, son of a bitch. Three soldiers are fussing behind my back. The first blow hit my kidneys. After a wallop at both ears at once, my head is spinning and ringing loudly. My glasses drop to the floor. That's him. The one standing on my side yells, "We've got you at last." They fist me for arms. Remember, this is a radio manager. He knew nothing of anything about arms, and they knew he didn't. This for the third or the fourth time within the last 10 hours. Standing with my back to the three of them, I can see beads of blood on the wall. They merge and trickle down, leaving a trail, which on drying gets darker. Your name? I give my name. Party affiliation? The Communist Party, I said. The fist originally intended for my face stopped short of my eye without touching it. You're a communist? And you're not ashamed to admit it? No, why should I be? The fist rises and comes down on my head. They rain blows on my neck, my back, and about my ears. Suddenly I get a knee blow from behind between the legs, doubling up from the excruciating, horrible pain. I gnash my teeth and clench my fist. Who was firing from the windows of the radio center? No one. We didn't have any arms, I said. You killed two of our new recruits. Who fired? You? If it was you, who was it? If it was not you, who was it? Out with it. Of course, they knew perfectly well that no one had been firing from that building. If anyone had, they would have shot us long ago. They would have also shot us on the spot had they found any arms at the radio station after our arrest. You were one of the snipers, right? No, I said I am a reporter. Are the ones arrested with you? Who was firing? If you name them, we'll take you home in a car. If you don't, you'll stay here a couple of months. 2 months of such detention. There'll be a people's rally tonight, of course, in the town forum. Let us begin it as promptly as possible. 7:15. If you don't, you'll stay here a couple of months, they said. 2 months of such detention. One of them says in my ear, in a hoarse voice, "All right, you didn't manage to get the arms from your hideout. Tell me where it is. Come on, tell me. I see you are tired, and we'll take you home immediately. Tell us where it is. We'll let you and your radio friends go home. And as far as we are concerned, nothing happened here. Did it? Now, where is it? You look like a gent. How can you cover up for these criminals and bastards? What are you waiting for? I told you we'll let you go home. Speak up." As expected, the officer's rehearsed politeness and the rather unexpected gentle persuasion are followed by an explosion of spluttering rage. This is typical of Police Tactics USA. Patty went through it when she was doing something brave for the people. One will be kind and the other will be brutal. Some of our people have been through this in USA, and I'm talking about Patty Cartmell and some others. The human body is an instrument which, although mute, thunders inside like a tight drum under a hail of blows and knocks dealt by three officers of our glorious armed forces in blind obedience to Pinochet's orders coming directly from USA. Three academy graduates, who of course were warmly applauded during military parades on the occasion of national holidays. Officers who regarded themselves as men of the world, who had received an education and military training. To stop for water, to enable them to stand guard over the frontiers of their country, to become specialists in the military sphere, but who were now acting as crude, hired torturers. These non-entities in officer's uniform, with complete impunity, were humiliating and taunting their fellow countrymen in response to orders so disastrous for their country, issued by those who had molded them in their own image. It was not the blows that inflicted the worst pain, but the realization of the sheer baseness and twisted mentality that drove these madmen, who were blinded by fury and hatred towards their prostrate victims, who were just gentle socialists, whom they had kicked into a condition in which, in their opinion, they must stay. Their aim is to humiliate us, to break our spirit, destroy our courage. They managed to get groans of pain and despair out of some of us, but not repentance. They fail in their attempts to make their prisoners repeat after them abuses for their country's president. No, not one spoke against Allende, nor of the supreme chief of the People's Armed Forces, who was killed a few hours ago during an operation which can only be described as a betrayal, and was instituted by USA imperialism. They claim to know what their country needs, and that they love and respect it, but they are traitors, a bunch of miserable goddamn traitors, pure and simple. We're gonna shoot you. They push me towards a corner, but it takes me some little effort to actually reach it. There I find a middle-aged man. His shirt is torn to shreds, and his face is all covered in blood. He stands motionless, keeping his hands raised on the wall. I stand beside him. I'm dying for a drink. Someone else is brought here. Now we are three. We are panting heavily as if after a long, grueling race. Dr. Allende has been murdered. How many more will they kill? Does this mean the end of the popular unity government, seized in the confusion of the military coup, which means a military takeover, which will one day happen in USA? If there's even the slightest resistance, which there will come, as hunger begins to embrace America, race riots, stirred up racial tensions, and all the problems because of the ecosystems, the droughts, the floods that are going to be causing shortages of foods in America, those dictatorships will come there too. Now the coup has come to Chile, seized in the confusion of this military dictatorship. We are like parts of a mechanism whose center has been removed. We are like limbs cut off from a felled trunk. It's midnight now. We've been in the defense ministry for over 4 hours now. Number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Once again, they are sorting us into batches of 5. That means the corridor of death once again. Hands on the back of your head. This time I have to run as number 2. That's better. The number 5 man, the tail gets the worst of it. Where will they take us now, I think? They'll finish us off, I hope. Those behind me whisper, "Nothing of the kind," replies the number 3 man. "We're just punch balls for these fascist bastards. At the double go. We've been through it before, keeping our heads low. We run between 2 rows of soldiers who spur us on with shouts and blows. By now, apparently, so many people have been forced through the humiliating ritual that the soldiers are beginning to show signs of weariness of it all. Their blows, though still hard, are less frequent, and their zeal is visibly reduced compared to what it was a few hours back. When we cross the by street, they order us to stop outside the open back of an army truck standing by the curb. Behind the truck and in front of it are 2 jeeps with soldiers armed with machine guns. I hope you in the machine shop are hearing this. I hope all of you that have ideas to defend ourselves are thinking about this. We scramble into the back of the truck one by one. Its floor is covered with shingle and sand. I said, I want you to listen to this. We fall onto it in face downwards. We are still supposed to keep our hands on the back of our head. We're not allowed to turn or lift our heads or to talk. I said, I want you to listen. I've got something like bronchial pneumonia in both lungs. I've got kidney infection. I've got a blood pressure that's enough to kill you. And something that requires me to go to the hospital, and I can't go because of people who are so anarchistic. I have to stay here and face the future and gladly do so. But at least I want to develop a people that are socialist, that are sensitive, that have got some gut and courage to stand up for communist principles. We lie flat on our faces for some time. 2 more groups of prisoners arrive, and they are put into army trucks in the same way. Soldiers holding machine guns trained on us are at the back of the truck. The trucks drive off for an unspecified destination. Again, we don't know where we're going. Chapter 3, He Who Does Not Skip, Stand By. Long time, we drive along deserted streets. It is impossible to guess the direction. You can't see beyond the dirty metal sides of the truck. You'll have to excuse me, I'm having a little difficulty with some insulin. Makes it a little difficult to see. My grazed elbows are hurting, and it is getting worse. Now we drive along an asphalted road, turn and proceed along a cobblestone stretch of roadway. Listen clearly, all of you. Maybe you might get to be a feeling socialist. You might stand up for your comrades like these brave Chileans did 5 years ago and are still standing up and not moaning or groaning and sure not pushing and shoving in food lines like I see you do so disagreeably, not griping about this, that, and some other little petty thing. Get what I've got in my heart while you can. Now we're on the back, on asphalt again. Then we drive along a brightly lit street, which is followed by complete darkness. Our truck slows down and drives under a yellow-colored arch. It seems we have arrived at our destination, but where? Our truck comes to a stop. There's a strong smell of petrol, gas fumes. Get down. With difficulty we get up and jump, or rather fall down. Line up 5 abreast. Hemmed in by guards on both sides, we run towards a one-story wooden building with a projecting roof. Our running feet set up a loud noise. We continue to run on the spot in front of an open door, spurred on by blows from rifle butts and bayonets, and a torrent of abuse. You can leave them here. They won't run anywhere. A further shower of abuse and blows from rifle butts, and then the guards leave. The room into which they have herded us, like goats or dogs or sheep, has benches arranged around the walls. They order us to sit down. Our eyes hurt from the brilliant glare of the lighting tubes on the ceiling. The only window is closed. Remember, this man went through this for years. This is only the first day. Standing at the entrance are several men in army uniform, a captain with a black beret on, a swarthy, tall, long-nosed NCO, and few soldiers, and some USA green beret. They look at us with curiosity. We are a wretched sight. Matted hair, shirts dirty, torn to shreds, jackets with sleeves torn off and the lining turned inside out, trousers in holes, and all this is stained with blood and urine and dirty with earth and dust. Our eyes glint with a mixture of bitterness, hate, and confusion, as we do not know what is in store for us. Our faces are all swollen and covered with bruises. We reek of the stink of long, unwashed bodies. Some had to shit in their pants. Before long, another two lots of detainees for the concentration camp arrived. Within 2 hours, the benches that stood here vacant when we arrived, and those that were brought in later, are packed with detainees. The new arrivals have to sit on the floor. Before long, the room is crammed with detainees, back to back, knee to knee. All around me, I again hear heavy breathing. You are at the quarters of the Boyne Regiment. You are in temporary detention, pending court-martial. And now everybody will go to the corridor and fall in. We do as we are told. Put your belts, ties, and shoelaces here, and your papers on the table there, then get back into lines. May we go to the toilet, someone asks? You may by turns, but not more than two at a time. Those wanting to go to the toilet raise their hands and make for the toilets, either to answer nature's call or to drink some of the toilet water. We are accompanied by guards who pilot us to the toilet and wait outside the door. Nearly all of us were suffering from the same need to first satisfy our biological needs. When urinating, we experienced such acute pain that it seemed that sharp claws were tearing the bladder and our genitals apart, and blood flowed together with the urine. It felt as if a web of fine wire covered our kidneys, pulling them down with such excruciating pain that some of us fainted. I've known that feeling, having had a bladder infection. But there's no way you can know quite the pain of being beaten like this unless you go through it. The rest of the night passed in painful trips to the toilet, after which the men groaned loudly and interminably, unable to go to sleep at all. At dawn, when the rays of the rising sun dispelled the darkness, we could see just how ashen and gray our faces had become. With only 2 or 3 hours of rest, after long hours of torture and humiliation and lack of sleep in a stuffy room, physical exhaustion made itself felt particularly. After long hours of motionless sitting on hard benches or on the floor, we felt more dead than alive, our muscles leaden with weariness, ached all over, and our bones hurt at the slightest movement. But again, I tell you, there's no pain like this that even moves me, the pain of being a leader. The pain of being drained on, the pain of not being able to stand with people like the Bread Brigade or people like this and resist. Although I would have resisted, they would have had to kill me. In the morning, they gave us some brownish brew that looked and tasted like diluted coffee. They made up several copies of a list with our name on it. One copy will remain here at Boyne, the concentration camp that they were in, to confirm that you were all brought here alive and kicking, and you'll be taken out of here alive, whether kicking or not. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they called in several of the detainees. Nice word they gave for those that were being held in concentration camps, and ordered them to rig up a long table made of planks in the corridor. That done, they distributed plastic bowls filled with bean soup, all mixed together in pieces of bread, one apiece. The swarthy NCO gave extra helpings to the four biggest of our group. Unarmed soldiers were looking at us from behind the armed guards and talking quietly among themselves as they left. When they opened the window to air the room, we caught a glimpse of trees, and in the distance of the San Cristobal Mountains, we could see the beauty of them. The sound of firing reached us from here. Helicopters flew overhead, and for a while the sound of firing got closer. After a time, all was quiet except for the singing of birds. We were given the list of names for us to check if they were correct. At 5 p.m. they began calling us in one by one. Suddenly the relative calm was broken by the announcement, "You are wanted by the military tribunal. We are going to take you back to the Ministry of Defense." We knew what was in store for us now. We would have to go through the nightmare of last night again. In single file, we walked past the pile of neckties out of which we had to fish the right one. In the same way we had to retrieve our belts and shoelaces, our papers were given back to us as one by one our names were called out. Then still in single file we were marched out into the courtyard where several Recoleto Matadero route minibuses with their engines running were waiting for us together with a few jeeps full of soldiers. "We are giving you a guard for your own safety. There are people wanting to kill you. We won't let that happen." We get into buses and take our seats. Guards with their rifles pointing at us are seated beside the driver and on the back seat. In the courtyard, soldiers in orange vests are relaxing in the shade, their steel helmets off. Steel helmets paid for by U.S. tax dollars, supplied by CIA, that should make all of us feel guilty that we were ever North American Yankees. Others get up, take their rifles, line up quickly, jump into trucks, and drive off. As we move off, accompanied by the guards, the soldiers in the courtyard follow us with indifferent eyes. There are a few of us as young as they. How embittered and angry they have become over the past 24 hours. Overnight, they have become soldiers who shot and killed their own fellow countrymen. Do they realize what they have done? Are they thinking of their families who are waiting for them in their slums? Hardly. More likely, the bombastic orders of their officers at the dawn briefing are still ringing in their ears, exhortations to use their arms against some undefined devilish force that had entrenched itself in Lumbunindo Palace, that was scattered in the working class suburbs, lying in ambush in industrial areas, setting up organizations of plotters to exterminate the officer corps, those true custodians of the honor of the tricolor, the great military that always succeed, destroying you, the democracy, even as it will in the United States. The great President Allende no longer was a person. He was just a myth to be feared. What they had to do now was maintain cast-iron discipline and carry out orders to the letter, and without hesitation, or they too would be in trouble. If you see a worker, pounce on him. Kill him first, before he gets you. The country will never forget you. A marble monument will be erected in your honor in the pantheon of the illustrious dead, where we'll rise in a halo of unfading glory, said the military officers that were speaking their shouting cries. Or perhaps they are thinking of their families back in the slums after all. We turn off into Recoleta Street and drive past two-storied houses whose facades badly need a fresh coat of paint. Washing lines are strung across the balconies and courtyards. Doors and windows are shut. Flags are hanging from some windows. Why? Deserted streets in the evening in Santiago is a most unlikely sight. We see no chairs outside front doors where the housewives so love to sit and gossip in an evening time. We see no children laughing merrily on the roadside, no lovers embracing. All this is oddly a dim memory now. It's hard to believe that this is our Chile that was free only just a few hours ago. Vega Central, swarms of flies surround the awnings of vegetable shops, crawling on wilting greens left lying in the sun. The Mapocho Railway Terminal, we see no porters in their red caps pushing trolleys laden high with suitcases and baskets, and there are no cab drivers offering their services so politely as had become the custom in socialist Chile. Flags waving from houses, and the houses stand with their doors and windows shut, deserted streets decked with flags waved against the walls and downpipes, fluttering over the ruins, over the scene of desolation and death, invisibly present in the hushed streets brought about by U.S. tax dollars and even direct military intervention of the U.S. Air Force. And then suddenly we see a huge crowd of people and hear a babble of voices and the noise of great activity. We are approaching the Estadio Nacional along Alameda Avenue. Imagine it if you were on Alameda Boulevard in Los Angeles. It'll happen one day. The approaches to the stadium are packed with cars and trucks full of people. There are large numbers of soldiers and Air Force and Naval personnel, all policemen, but the majority are detainees. Lined up in a long, tight row, they are bobbing up and down, doubling on the spot, along the whole of the narrow street before the main gates to the stadium and Alameda Avenue. For the length of several blocks are pulsating lines of people. We climb out of the minibuses with a sense of release that we are at the Estadio Nacional and not in the gloomy, oppressive silence of the defense ministry, now taken over by the fascists, backed by the U.S. CIA. However, we soon discover that the lies told us by those who sent us from the Boeing barracks are the lesser evil compared to what is waiting us at the stadium. As soon as we get off the buses, we are made to join the bobbing dance being performed by the rest of the detainees. You have to jump up and down continually, keeping your hands on the back of your head. That was the order. Moving along slowly in this fashion, we gradually approach the main entrance to the stadium, spurred on by the guards who form a rigid wall between the groups of jogging detainees approaching from different directions. Our particular row winds amid a swaying sea of heads, now appearing, now disappearing from view behind a row of bayonets. We are panting so heavily. Not the military, however, who are obviously delighting in the humiliating spectacle they have so cleverly organized. The setting sun dips behind the roofs. We keep on dancing in the twilight. He who doesn't skip is a mummy, isn't he? An officer shouts gleefully. The military are jeering at us in cynical reference to the street rallies in the winter of 1970 during the election campaign when we won freedom for the workers of Chile. On one occasion, the young people, in order to keep warm, began skipping and chanting cheerfully, "He who doesn't skip is a mummy." This cheerful mood quickly transmitted itself to all. Eventually, the leaders of the platform also began skipping. At the rally held at the Estadio Nacional on November 4, 1970, when Allende was sworn in as country's president, all the participants responded to the young people's call with enthusiasm and began skipping everywhere, in the aisles, on the stands, on the football pitch, and the running tracks. For several minutes, the whole of the stadium was chanting the call, skipping in unison in those days with linked arms upraised because freedom had come to Chile. It was a spontaneous eruption of youthful cheerfulness and determination to make a clean break with the fossilized conventions of those who had suffered crushing defeat at the elections that had been backed by U.S. imperialism. The people of Chile had to break the economic stranglehold of the mummies. With the help of popular organizations, which were mushrooming up and down the country, this was an optimistic start to a process that was eventually to culminate in emerging of the nation's ideals. Now this process has been brutally halted, and they're taking the very words that we said, that we don't skip to the joy of working class liberation, we're mummies. They were making everyone there jump till they would fall in exhaustion. He who doesn't skip is a mummy. Whose perverted mind was it that brought thoughts up this disgusting way to humiliate the people? How this psychological additive harmonizes with their concept of total war against their own people, some their own families? An army that takes an open, unarmed city has little claim to any glory. But such is the nature of armies. When an army occupies the towns and cities of its own country, which are defenseless precisely because it is this army which is in duty bound to defend them, this is no war but barbarism and perfidy, evil, evil calumny. And what do the strategists of the military overthrow, the coup, think of their handiwork? More than likely, they are highly pleased with themselves. It is like the delight of an imbecile contemplating the mess he has just made in his own bed. When someone flags the guard, hits him in the back with a rifle butt. He who does not skip is beat down with a bayonet. The oscillating sea of heads moves in a dull, monotonous rhythm, bobbing up and down. He who does not skip, knocked down to the ground. Dust fell. We're all panting and gasping for breath.
Our bodies are covered with a film of sticky sweat. All we hear is the clanging of metal and the creaking of leather belts. There are children in school uniforms in the columns of prisoners, little children that are being tortured. There are youths in military uniforms in the columns of prison officers. The gold braid of their shoulder straps glitters brightly. They trample on books ground to shreds by their heels, as all books on freedom and socialism had to be burned in gigantic book-burning exercises that goes on in every fascist takeover, and has even taken place in cities in America when books were banned in the McCarthy era. A captain in a black beret appears. He's from the Bruin Barracks. Pointing towards the central entrance to the stadium, he gives some orders which we fail to understand fully. Separating ourselves from the bobbing, wheezing crowds of prisoners, we run into the direction indicated, then up a staircase and into the stadium. The captain stands in front of us, brandishing a sheaf of papers. He indicates the place we are to occupy. There should be no talking, only listening. You will know this text. Understand me? I don't know my future, but you must have this knowledge. Somebody has to carry on the ideals. This captain indicates the place we are to occupy, the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth benches. Sat, now see the people listen. He proceeds to call the roll. That done, the captain clicks his heels, turns about smartly and leaves. I demand listening today because I said my blood pressure is at an enormous high level. My blood sugar is so difficult I don't see clearly. I've got a kidney and bladder infection and I've carried a temperature for days. Who knows where the future lives, what it brings. But while I have time, I will inspire socialism. If I have to do it through the means of revolutionary discipline. My love requires that. I could give you no less than the heritage of my sensitivity and my socialist concern. I'll come through if you come through, if you show you care enough to listen, to feel the pain, to identify with the pain of those who are suffering this very hour, from Africa right down in Chile to Southeast Asia, for the principles that we hold dear. Marxist-Leninism, socialism that leads to the perfect road of communism. Later we almost felt grateful to this captain by putting us in the lower sections to the right of the spot where they usually set up a platform for open-air concerts and performances. He saved us from the savage beatings meted out on September 12, 1973, to 7,000 Chileans and foreign nationals outside the entrance to the stadium, where they were to spend several nightmarish days and nights of continual beatings organized for them by butchers in military uniforms paid for by U.S. tax dollars that we all should feel guilt about. Because every time we bought a hamburger or a Coca-Cola, taxes on that we bought went to buy the uniforms for beasts like this all over the world. This was designed to cow into submission those who had been overwhelmed in the bitter struggle. Excuse me, I have to take some more water. My throat's like a boil. From the second lower section of the stadium, from the far side of the basketball ground, about 600 people are peering across at us with silent intensity. They are tightly packed together, their eyes wide open, their attitudes betraying inward tension. So why are you reading it? Well, I'm certainly not reading it to get any sympathy, because I don't expect any. I'm reading it because I know I've got the feeling. I've got the compassion. I've got the commitment to read it. I can see a few familiar faces. They are students, faculty members, and officials of the State University of Technology. I can see two small children clinging to their gray-haired father, who is dressed only in his underwear. The rest of the stadium is so far empty. The vacant space will be filled by those who are being put through the 48-hour admission ritual outside the entrance to the stadium. Like us before, They were ordered to lie flat on the ground, face down, to put their watches, wallets, neckties, papers, monies, keys, belts, pencils and pens, notebooks, rings, everything so forth in neat piles beside them, which were immediately picked up and put into apple boxes. After they were beaten with rifle butts and bayonets and a full list of their names were made, then they were ordered to stand facing the wall with their hands up. They were thoroughly stretched for arms, searched for arms or bits of paper they had failed to surrender. They were beaten again, this time on the genitals, the vagina, the penis, the balls, the privates. After that, one by one, hands on the back of their heads, they were ordered to retake their places in the columns at the double. This is U.S. imperialism. This is fascism that we should be glad to die to resist. Columns of detainees stretched along the upper and lower rows and along the balconies and stands around the stadium. At dawn on the following morning, Thursday, a few score barefooted people, bloody and beaten in blue overalls, were herded into the football pitch and ordered to sit on the turf. They were our comrades from the Horizonte printing office, which until September 11 had printed El Siglo, Puro Chile, and other publications of the militant left. They were arrested following a raid on the communist printing office, which heralded a new wave of repressions against its staff. I recognized Barilla among them. He was barefooted like the rest, in shirt sleeves, minus his glasses, which were so much a part of him. A veteran printer was he, a man of few words. Barilla had been on the staff of Horizonte for many years, had mastered every printing trade and trained others. Eventually he was appointed manager of the printing office. My heart missed a beat when I saw what they had done to them at the Tacana barracks. In 1957, Horizonte was raided by political police who wrecked the printing office and arrested the entire staff. And yet they kept on holding to their ideals. They were jailed in the rawest parts of Chile, in the winter weather, even freezing their feet and limbs. Then, as now, they were seized at dawn, savagely beaten and bundled off without being given a chance to dress properly. They were released following a massive protest movement by Chilean workers in those days, who also collected money to pay for bringing the printing press back into production. How many times did they raid Horizonte? How many times did they arrest and even kill members of its staff? But the printing office rose from its ashes every time. Just as often as they were oppressed, they rose again. Even earlier in 1948, during the tyranny of President Gonzalez Videla, Horizonte fell victim to the rampaging oligarchy, the rich rule of a few landed owners, and was closed down. At the time, it was managed by Américo Zorrilla, once a printing worker himself, who was the first minister of finance. I'm sorry, to pause for coughing, who was the Minister of Finance in the Popular Unity Government that was overthrown just 2 days ago, which seems like a lifetime now. Despite the fact that the printing office was sealed at that time and its entire staff incarcerated or jailed in the Pisagua concentration camp, thanks to the efforts of the workers, patriotic papers continued to come out. They were distributed by members of the underground, and in this way they contributed to the organization and intensification of the struggle that resulted in the isolation of the corrupt regime and its final fall from power. And now the Horizonte printing office has been wrecked again. Once again it has fallen victim to a monstrous outrage upon the most progressive section of the working people of Chile. For sheer cruelty, this action can only be matched by the savage repressions at the start of the century in Chile, when workers' leaders were treated as bandits and troops and police were ordered to shoot them summarily. Strange as it may seem, the presence at the stadium of our comrades from Horizonte fills us with a fierce faith that we will rise again and win back inch by inch the gains won by the Chilean people in a bitter and hard struggle. It fills us with faith that this defeat is no more than a lesson of history, which we must learn very well to ensure that the power of our next onslaught against the ruling class is such as we'll never again allow our people to be trampled down. And at this very moment, there's labor unrest taking place in Chile that might guarantee just that. When at the start of the century, Recabarren organized a joint action by workers and peasants in northern Chile, they also went through tortures and privations, misery which are our lot now. In Punta Arenas, the workers were herded into trade unions, headquarters, and burned alive. In Punta Arenas, the workers were herded into trade union headquarters and burned alive. In Antofagasta, they were driven out into the Pampa and made to run while troops shot them in the back. That was the day before the military had become civilized. In Valparaiso, they were put into sacks and thrown into the ocean to drown alive and be fed to sharks. In Temuco and Colchuaga, they were trussed up inside pigsties and left to be eaten by the pigs. In Iquique, in the course of one day, several thousand workers were brutally murdered. In Ronquil, all the local peasants and their families were shot and their houses burned down with many times their children in them. These atrocities, however, failed to produce the results the executioners had hoped for. Could it be that today's executioners, using the old methods, will succeed in retaining power which they have seized with Washington's help, with USA direct help? Recabarren, the printing workers of Horizonte, where you two worked at one time are now in prison just as you were at one time, but they will regain their freedom with the help of those who are alive. Our newspaper El Siglo will again come out as it did in the past when the printing workers worked all night after night to get the paper out in the morning, the paper which guided the fist of the working class. These 3 years of dignity for Chile under the freedom, socialist, popular unity government will remain a lesson to be learned and an aim to be attained. Your party, El Siglo, is still in the van leading the working class. The coal miners will again march on. Concepcion, the workers of the saltpetri mines, the saltpeter mines, will tear down the emblems of the pillaging North American U.S. gangsters which were imposed upon them by force of arms. The copper mine workers are not alone. The field has been sown. Just one step remained to the goal of socialism of which you wrote and which you taught us to love, and we shall take that step. The whole stadium is filled to bursting point with prisoners. New batches of detainees are being driven into the aisles outside the glass doors of the main entrance. All this sea of humanity is illuminated by tinted searchlights set up round the stadium, blazing at full power. Heavy machine guns are trained on us from special platforms rigged up for the purpose. Our guards are also there to keep their guns pointed at us and to look at us with glee glaring, laughing at us all the time. This is our second night without sleep. The sound of firing reaches us from outside. Yes, from outside the stadium. Some are still resisting. They are stimulating those who have remained outside skipping for over 12 hours. Anyone that did not skip was tortured immediately on the spot. Chapter 4. It's called The Prince. Written by Rolando Carrasco, Chile's prisoners of war, who spent several years in the concentration camps before Moscow, the great Soviet Union, the vanguard of Marxist liberation and liberation of all people, demanded his release and brought about a trade of prisoners. The prince, he is a tall, strong young man with fair hair and green eyes. He is a crew cut and is in a well-cut and closely fitting uniform. In his hands he holds an elegant, flexible, and obedient whip. Remember, town forum meeting tonight, 7:15. All be there on time. In the meantime, security see that everyone listens. I have the feeling of necessity to convey knowledge and sensitivity while I have time. This young man tries to reinforce his external manly appearance with a deep, booming baritone. But when he struts about looking at us ever so haughtily from the elevation of his officer rank, we notice that his hips are swaying in a way that makes his muscular figure look rather surprisingly like that of a woman. When he addressed us for the first time, he pushed the microphone, which was connected to powerful loudspeakers around the Estadio Chile aside. "Hey, you below, can you hear me?" "Yes." "And you up above, can you hear me too?" "Yes." "And you in that corner, can you hear me well?" "Yes." "And you foreign garbage, can you hear me?" "Yes." "I've got the voice of the prince, haven't I?" He was in command. He was in charge of receiving and accommodating detainees. All the members, thousands and thousands, great percentage of the Chilean population, black, white, all races, brown, that were being put in concentration camps to be tortured for years. By his order, a whole row of detainees were shifted from one side of the stadium to the opposite one, only to be moved back where it was 4 hours later. He repeatedly reminded us of the security rules over and over at the stadium, and of his determination to make us observe them unswervingly, pointing out to us the faithful obedience of his men to torture and to kill us if we did not. "The machine guns up there, you see them, are 50 caliber. The bullets don't just go through, they slash you to ribbons. The machine guns at the corners are 30s. They can also cut you in half. My men, as you can see, have submachine guns too, and I can assure you they know how to use them. But to you that are listening, there's only just a few seconds to unconsciousness, and death comes to all. Why not allow death come with dignity? And even you may think that socialism falls. It looked like it had, if you remember, in the movie Z in Greece. But today we see the Socialist and Communist Party rise up and overthrow and bring to court for sentencing the despots that rule Chile, that rule Greece for 10 long years. My man, are you...